/Charlotte.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Ambassadors are by nature and occupation diplomatic. Their comments are guarded and crafted to put their points across without stepping on too many toes. And I'm sure that Gérard Araud, the French ambassador to the United States, follows those rules as often as he can, but he's also known for speaking his mind and, according to some sources, has cultivated an online reputation as one of diplomacy's feistiest and frankest practitioners. We're going to be talking about that as we go through the hour this morning, but because of the news of the day, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about what's going on in Belgium. But first, let me welcome Gérard Araud to our microphones and to Charlotte. Welcome.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us, by the way. And he's here under the auspices of the World Affairs Council, Charlotte. Incidentally, he'll be speaking at noon today at the Hilton Center City. There are still seats available for that lunch, and you can get to the World Affairs Council Charlotte through our website at WFAE.org. Let's start with the news of the morning. At least two attacks in Brussels at an airport, at the airport, and at the subway. They've closed the subways. They've closed the train. They've shut down the airport so far. As far as we know, 26 people are reported dead. On Morning Edition a few minutes ago, we heard from a restaurant owner in Brussels who said that she felt Europe was at war. And I think that one of the European or the Brussels officials has also said that this morning in the news, that Europe is at war. Is that a fair assessment?
Unfortunately, I think yes. And the French Prime Minister has said that we are at war. I'm not that surprised by these attacks. And because we have thousands of young Europeans who have gone to Syria. They are there or they are back. And when they are back, of course, they are military trained and they are radicalized. We have not identified all of them. So we are facing networks all over Europe. And sooner or later, we knew that we couldn't foil all the attempts of attacks. My Minister of Interior was in Washington, D.C. last week, and he said that in 2015, France alone has foiled 12 attempts of attack.
If we are at war, if Europe is at war, with whom are you at war? Because this is a sticky question that we in the United States have been trying to figure out for quite a while, and we've been prosecuting this war in a conventional way, and we're not fighting a nation state. We're fighting an ideology. So if you're at war, with what are you at war, and how do you plan, given what you've seen with regard to our successes and our failures, how would you prosecute that war?
I think it's a good question. We are facing a threat which is fueled first by the war in Syria and Iraq. As I've said, thousands of Europeans are going there to fight the jihad, and they are coming back radicalized. But it's fueled also by radical Islam. You know, 99.99% of the Muslims in Europe are peaceful, but it happens that there are very tiny minorities, a few thousand of people, who are radicalized and who are decided that they want to strike the European society, which means our liberal values. So in a sense, it's not a war in the traditional sense, even if actually we are fighting in Syria and Iraq against ISIS in a very traditional way. There are French planes which are bombing ISIS. But it's also a war in the brains of our citizens, and especially in the brains of our Muslim citizens.
This attack today in Brussels comes a day after or 2 days after they apprehended one of the masterminds of the attacks on Paris in November, and evidently a number of the attackers in Paris in November hid out or lived in Belgium. Is this a challenge to the open borders of the European Union? Because the whole idea, the whole dream of the success of the European Union is to get rid of passports between all these various countries and let people flow across the border as they do from state to state in the United States. Does this end that?
Of course, it's a challenge to the open borders. A lot of borders actually within Europe are not open anymore. A lot of European countries.
That's why I asked the question.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of European countries have decided to close their border, as they are allowed to do it in emergency situation. because we are facing not only the problem of the terrorists, but also the problem of migrants. You know, more than 1 million of migrants entered Europe last year, and we have every day 2,000 migrants arriving in Greece. So we have also the problem of the migrations. So for the moment, a lot of borders are closed. We are facing this threat. Our hope is that after we have won, it will be possible to go back to an open Europe.
In addition to all these migrants coming in from Syria and other places in the Middle East fleeing the violence there, there are Europeans, hundreds of Europeans who carry European passports who are coming back from Syria. Does this closing of borders, this increased security, does it impact them in any way?
Actually, we have discovered that, for instance, when Europeans are re-entering the European area, what we call the Schengen area, where borders are open, they are not even we don't know they are coming back. So it's very important that before reopening the borders within Europe, we close our borders out of Europe, that our borders become real borders for the protection of our security. So the European authorities have taken some decisions, to put on our external borders more guards, and that we should have a more effective means to know who is entering our continent. Maybe we have been too open in the past. The security for the moment is the most important constraint.
But if you're closing borders, particularly the internal borders between Italy and France and Germany and Belgium, is that effectively the end of the European Union?
No. First, the European Union has existed with border control. There is a difference between the European Union and what we call the Schengen area. For instance, the border of the UK, the United Kingdom, is not member of the Schengen area, and the border of UK has never been opened. Mm-hmm. So you can be member of the European Union without having open borders. To be frank, the idea of opening or closing the borders has a political appeal. You know, really, for the citizens, the idea of saying, oh, my borders are closed, give a sense of protection. In fact, when you have countries like France or Belgium, France and Germany, you can enter the country, you can pass the borders very easily. Between France and Belgium, you cross a street and you are in Belgium. Mm-hmm. And when we say that we close the border, it does not mean that we close the streets. We simply have controls on the main roads. So if you want to pass from France to Belgium, it's still possible.
Is that effective then? If you're trying to up security and you don't close every entry point?
No, I think it's not that effective, really, because considering the geography of, it's like if
then
you want to close the border between North Carolina and South Carolina. You can put checkpoints on the main roads. You can't put checkpoints. Right. You are not going to build a wall.
It depends on who's the president. The capture the other day of the mastermind of the Paris plots in Belgium raised a lot of questions about the quality and the amount of intelligence that's being gathered and shared, I guess, by governments. And originally, as I understand it, they believe that the number of people involved in the Paris attack was around 10. Now it has grown to 30 and probably more. And they're uncovering more unsuspected people because of the capture of this individual the other day. You spent time serving in the Middle East in the diplomatic corps. Do you have any insight into the minds of the people that we are up against?
It's true that I guess that we had underestimated the threat. As I have said, we have not identified all of our citizens who have gone to Syria. They don't call us before leaving to Syria. A lot of them also are coming back under false identity, because the ISIS, the Islamic Caliphate, has created a place where they are making false identity cards, false passports. And we have 2,000 refugees arriving every day. During the spring and the summer, it was 6,000 or 8,000. So it's very difficult to follow or to guess who is a terrorist, to follow them. So we have a wide networks throughout Europe. And it's true also that the intelligence services of the different European countries, you know, maybe they have not worked together. They have not, for instance, the data they had, you know, have not been put in common. Mm-hmm. So that's also a lesson for us. And we are doing our best to improve our cooperation.
One of the things that we in the United States discovered after 9/11 is that our various security and investigative branches of government, the FBI and the CIA and other organizations, local police, didn't communicate with each other. What is the situation in Europe, both between the various police divisions within France and between France and other countries in the European Union?
No, in a sense, if you had this problem in one country, the United States, you can guess it's still worse in Europe. You know, really, first, intelligence services, they don't like simply to share the data they have. The computer systems are not compatible, and so on and so on. So we have to build an European response because it's an European threat. The people who have attacked Paris were coming from Belgium, and some people actually had crossed all the borders of Europe. So we have to work together. We have a system, a common system of intelligence called the Schengen system, but it has not been fed correctly by most of the intelligence services in Europe. So I'm convinced that now, because of the emergency, things are going to improve.
Will that be easy or will it be very difficult? Despite the emergency, there are still territorial protections involved in these various agencies. Will it be easy to break those down and to share more information and to collect more information?
Of course, it won't be easy, but we
In other words, do the French trust the Belgians to come across with information that might protect against a future Paris attack?
The Belgians are our very close friends, so we have a very good relationship with them. We are working also very well with the British, very well with the Germans.
Does it surprise you that this individual that masterminded the attacks on Paris was able to hide out for as long as he did in Belgium, and I'm told it's within 500 yards of where his parents live? They must have known he was there. Others must have known he was there. This indicates a pretty tight-knit, closed-lipped group of people who are not set on violence, are certainly willing to protect those who are set on violence.
Now, it's obvious that what has happened in Paris and what is happening right now in Brussels, is raising a lot of questions about Brussels. Obviously, Brussels had become a center for terrorist activities, and we have to support, to help our Belgian friends, to fight it and to dismantle all the networks which could have their center in this city. But, you know, I don't know if you remember, there was in a tale by Edgar Poe about the hidden letter. You know, you are looking for a letter in a room, and the best way to hide it is simply to put the letter on the desk, because nobody will think that the hidden letter is actually the one on the desk.
Hiding in plain sight.
Really, so I think Brussels was more or less the hidden letter of Edgar Poe.
Our guest today is the ambassador of France to the United States, Gérard Araud. He was with us under the auspices of the World Affairs Council. Charlotte, we're going to come back and talk more about what's going on today in Belgium and within the European Union, because they face this massive migrant crisis as well. And then we'll get into some other lighter topics with the ambassador in a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Honda of Concord, committed to customer service, satisfaction, and bringing excellence to the car buying experience, offering a selection of over 700 new and pre-owned vehicles. Details at hondaofconcord.com. And Doctors Making House Calls, serving patients in their home or workplace, all insurance accepted. Registration information available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Never wait in a doctor's office again. Big data is something we all know a little bit about, and we should, because big data is made up of all the things about us being collected by business and industry and places like Facebook. But the amount of data collected is so immense that the big data boom that we talked about a couple of years ago has not been realized. More talent is needed to make sense of it all, and UNC Charlotte is jumping into that challenge. We'll talk about that tomorrow at 9.
Families of 9/11 victims confront things they could never imagine as they observe the judicial proceedings of those accused of planning the 9/11 attacks.
The man that orchestrated my father's murder, he was waving at me and smiling at me and looking in my eyes.
Inside the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is the Ambassador of France to the United States, Gérard Araud. He's with us under the auspices of the World Affairs Council. They're having a luncheon today at the Hilton Center City. There's still seats available for that, and you can get to them through our website at WFAE.org. This attack on Brussels today, on Paris in November, the previous attack on Charlie Hebdo a year before that, is coming also at the time of a war in Syria in which hundreds of thousands, millions of people are exiting Syria, and a tidal wave of them are coming into the European Union. And Europe has been trying to deal with this massive inflow of people. Do you expect to see any changes in how Europe deals with these people in light of these recent attacks?
As you know, first, the figures are astonishing. More than 1 million of migrants entered Europe. It's like if you had 3-4 million of people crossing the Rio Grande. So it's technically very difficult to handle. And in political terms, since in Europe we have the same wave of populism, same wave of anti-immigrant feelings that you have in your own country, of course it's feeding this the far right in Europe. So it's politically and technically a real challenge. 2,000 migrants, I've said, every day arriving on the shores of Greece. And in the summer and the spring, we can expect 6,000 or 8,000. So we needed to have a European response. And we have been negotiating with Turkey because they are coming through Turkey, so that Turkey could close, you know, really.
Walk me, because that evidently was decided last week. Walk us through the details of that agreement between the European Union and Turkey.
So first, we have to understand that Turkey itself is overwhelmed by the migrants. 6 million of Syrians have been obliged to leave their own country. And around 3-4 million are in Turkey. On the top of that, you have a lot of migrants coming from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from all the war zones, and they are coming to Turkey. So we have to help the Turks to handle this flow. And the Europeans are going, you know, to give $6 billion to the Turks for the refugee camps, for the integration of the refugees. That's the first part. The second part is the Turks have to close the borders, but also we are trying to organize the entrance of the refugees, of some of the refugees, into Europe. For the moment, all the refugees who are in Greece will be sent back to Turkey, and afterwards there will be an orderly process according to the international law so that we can process the refugees one by one in a decent way. For the moment, the Greek authorities are simply overwhelmed.
If you can't close your borders between France and Belgium, how can Turkey close the border?
Well, it's quite different because, you know, really, it's between Belgium and France, you know, it's a land border. So, you know, you can walk and cross the borders. Between Turkey and Greece, you know, there is the sea. So I'm ready to admit that it won't be 100% effective, mm-hmm. but it can be much, much more effective than it is today.
In the wake of the Paris attacks, when this migration out of Syria also began, a lot of U.S. governors decided they made a stand and said they would not allow Syrian immigration into their states. I'm not sure that they can avoid that, but they said they wouldn't allow it. At the same time, your French president, François Hollande, increased from 24,000 to 30,000 the number of migrants that he promised to take in. Why did he do that? That was back in November, right after the attacks. Why did he do that?
It's, you know, the solution of the problem can be only European. The Germans have taken 1 million of immigrants. They have been incredibly generous, and they are overwhelmed. You know, they are obliged to put the migrants in gymnasium, in schools, in airports. We have to help them. And in a sense, when we say 30,000 compared to the 1 million which went to Germany, or the 160,000 to Sweden, I think it's not such a big figure. Mm.
Should our governors, including our North Carolina governor, Pat McCrory, has said that he won't allow Syrian refugees to be put in North Carolina. Once again, I'm not sure that's legal, but that's what he and other Republican governors have said. What do you think about that? Are they misguided?
As a foreign diplomat, I don't discuss domestic American topics.
Let me flip it around then, because there are stories that come out of Europe that say that it is very difficult for people from these other cultures to assimilate into French culture, into German culture, into the European way of life. Now you're facing millions of people coming in. Not only does that provide a logistical problem for you, does it not threaten your way of life? If you have millions of people who think differently, act differently, dress differently, have different customs, what becomes of France? What becomes of Germany?
No, you know, people forget that immigration has never been easy, and you know, it has not been solved in a sort on the short term. If you look at the American history, you should remember that the Italians were, you know, considered as aliens to the Anglo-Saxon culture, to the Protestant culture of the U.S. It was the same thing with the Irish, the same thing with the Jews. There were riots against the immigrants in this country in the 19th century. And, you know, and in 1920, you closed totally your borders because you felt that the white civilization was threatened by the immigrants from Eastern Europe. So it's always complicated. And usually everybody is saying that the immigrants who are the last comers are not easy to assimilate because they are a bit different. So as for the Muslims, you know, most of them have been in Europe for actually two generations. And when you look at them, you see that 99.9% are actually well assimilated.
But is it difficult for them to assimilate? Do they want to assimilate? That's number one. Number two, is it difficult? Do the French people look at these people as French once they've been there for a generation or two?
Again, the question is legitimate because, in a sense, in America is a country of immigrants. Every American has immigrants as ancestors. While in Europe, it's quite different. You know, all my ancestors are buried in the same village for three or four centuries. Mm-hmm. So it's more complicated. But Europe is becoming also a continent of immigration. And the immigrants have exactly the same rights that the other citizens. Most of them are French citizens. It means that also on the French side, we have also to adjust to this new reality. And I admit that it's not always the case.
How difficult do you see it being?
In a sense, the main problem that we have been facing now for 10 years is the economic crisis. Because we have had in Europe, not only in France, a high rate of unemployment. And as you know, the best integration of immigrants is through the jobs. We have 10% of unemployment in France. And as usual, it means that for the immigrants, it's a rate of 20% or more than 20%. We need growth. We need economic growth for all the French, but especially, I guess, for the immigrants.
You have universal health care, don't you?
We have universal health care and free education.
So when these migrants come in, mm-hmm. are unemployed because they haven't assimilated into the culture yet, they just arrived. They don't have jobs yet. They just arrived. and you haven't got the growth perhaps to create those jobs yet, they're on the healthcare system? They're
yes.
on the free education system?
They are, yes.
How do you afford that?
Yes.
How does any country afford that?
No, first, I think that's a question that the far right is raising in a regular manner, saying that these immigrants, these illegal immigrants, you know, actually shouldn't really have a free health care. The answer is human decency, legal or not illegal.
But there's only so much money.
You know, we can afford it. You know, we are an affluent country. We can afford it. And again, the most important factor is human decency. When somebody is sick, he should be treated, whatever is his legal status.
I want to get back to something that you said a moment ago about not commenting on American domestic policy, because I'm not sure that's necessarily true. In the aftermath of the Paris attacks, the ones on Charlie Hebdo, Donald Trump tweeted that, isn't it interesting that the tragedy in Paris took place in one of the toughest gun control countries in the world, to which you responded on Twitter, this message is repugnant in its lack of any human decency, and you called him a vulture. Believe that you're
I deleted this tweet.
Yes, I know.
You know, in the 5 minutes, following 5 minutes.
I know that you were asked to delete it, and you did, but was there any other blowback? I mean, after all, Donald Trump is running for president. I'm not sure he was running for president at the time of that tweet, but he is today. Well, how much blowback was there?
Well, actually, I had not so much on this tweet, but it happens that I went just after the Paris attack. I was interviewed by Fox News, and I was asked a question about
right.
guns, and I answered. You know, it was just at the end of the interview, so I was nearly leaving the room, and I said, these guns to protect you in such a terrorist attack, it works only in the movies. And my God, when I was, I went home, you know, I had hundreds of tweets, you know, attacking me and criticizing me and even threatening me. So I've decided that I'm not going to touch the guns issue anymore in my lifetime.
Well, let me ask you about it anyway.
I knew it.
If you have the toughest gun laws in the world, and I'm not sure.
And
that
we don't
do.
Have.
Okay.
Actually, it's Japan, which has by far the toughest law.
What are your laws? What can French citizens have in the world?
No,
way
you can. Weaponry? You can to buy a weapon, a gun in France. You have to have a good reason. So
what would that be?
For instance, if you are a hunter, mm-hmm. Which means that you have a hunting permit, mm-hmm. so you are allowed to buy specific weapons for hunting. Or if you feel threatened, for instance, if you have a jewelry, you know, you are selling jewels, you can consider that you need to be protected. So you are allowed to buy a gun, you know. But again, we are not allowed to have assault rifle in my country.
So no AK-47s.
Sorry, no.
No AK-47. No high velocity. Attack rifle, military-style rifle.
And I think it's important because, you know, we have two types of threat, terrorist threat in France. I have referred to the most deadly one, which is the people coming from Syria. They are networks, and they can find weapons, you know, because they are trafficking of weapons coming from the Balkans. But you have also the self-radicalized youth. For instance, we had a 15-year-old teenager who was radicalized on the internet and decided that he wanted to kill a Jew. But in France, you know, you don't have guns, so he could have only a knife. He bought a knife and he attacked and injured a Jewish teacher. Mm-hmm. You know, really. So it's important, you know, also not to have access to guns for this type of terrorism.
Are the gun laws in most of the rest of Europe, at least the countries that surround you, similar?
Yes, they are.
When you have attacks such as the ones on Paris, the one on Belgium, and some of the other isolated incidents around Europe, do the citizens feel safe? Do they feel that they would have been more safe had they had access to arms?
No, actually, it's the opposite. The pressure that we are feeling right now is that we should prevent the trafficking of weapons. Mm. We should be much more stringent in controlling the weapons.
It's exactly the opposite of what people are saying here. How do you explain that?
I think, you know, again, when you are a diplomat and when you are a foreigner living in a foreign country, you discover that there are a lot of issues which are linked to the culture, to the civilization. The guns issue is an American issue. It's really part of your culture, part of your history. And every country has to solve its own problems in its own way. So do it in American way in America. We won't do it in American way in Europe. We will do it in a European way. You know, every year, more than 400 policemen are killed by guns in this country. In Europe, it's less than 10, and in Japan, it's zero. Mm. So that's a different culture.
Earlier, we talked about how many in Europe, including yourself, I believe, feel that you're in a war with these people who would who want to destroy Western civilization or Western culture, let's put it that way, and want to everybody to acclimate to their view of life and their view of how the world should be run. You were posted in the Middle East for many years. People in this country, we've been fighting this war for 12 years now, I think, 13 years. There are many people in this country who are now saying, why are we fighting these wars? We kind of helped create the problem of ISIS, but why are we the ones who are expected to finish it? Why aren't the people in the Middle East, who are also threatened by this, why aren't they fighting it? They have money. They have armies. They have all the resources. Why are we doing it? What's your response to that?
No, first, I think it's a good point to say that Western intervention has not always been very positive. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a major geopolitical disaster. You know, it has been a main source of the instability of the region, because Iraq was, with all its shortcomings, was a basis for some stability, and especially some stability versus Iran. You know, now Iraq has disappeared as a functioning state. You have Syria, which is the victim of a civil war, which means that all the region, all the geopolitical balance of the region has been destroyed. Mm-hmm. So I think that you can say, let the countries of this part of the world solve their own problems. The only question is, they don't do it. They don't do it.
Is that because we do it? And if we stop doing it, they would? Or is it because they don't see it as a problem?
I think it's because they are deeply divided. There are major geopolitical rifts, for instance, between Iran and the Sunni states. Mm-hmm. They don't have the same. Also, they don't have the same analysis of the threat that we have. For the Europeans and for the Americans, I think that we can put ISIS on the top of the list. For some countries in like Saudi Arabia, I think they should put Iran on the top of the list. So when you look at the region, I think we are the only ones to consider ISIS as the main threat.
When we come back, let's talk about Iran for a moment, because you were involved in the nuclear negotiations with them. Gérard Araud is our guest, the ambassador of France to the United States. We're taking a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Robinson Bradshaw, committed to providing collaborative legal solutions to the business community. Offices in Charlotte, Rock Hill, and the Research Triangle, RobinsonBradshaw.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock this morning, WFAE will bring you live coverage from NPR of President Obama's keynote speech during his historic visit to Cuba. He'll be talking to the Cuban people from the Gran Teatro de la Habana, and we'll bring it to you live starting at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes here on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation with the French ambassador to the United States, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Get to us through WFAE on Facebook or at Charlotte Talks on Twitter. And we're coming right back.
I'm WFAE General Manager Joe O'Connor. Thank you to everyone who contributed during our spring membership campaign. Over 2,200 listeners contributed over $275,000 to help pay for quality journalism and compelling storytelling that engages, enriches, and inspires community. If you have yet to give, please consider a donation at WFAE.org. Thank you again for supporting WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest, the Ambassador of France to the United States, Gérard Arrault, who is in town because of the World Affairs Council Charlotte. He's speaking today at noon at the Hilton City Center, and you can go to that if you register, and you can do that through our website at WFAE.org. That will get you to the World Affairs Council website. Let's talk about Iran for just a moment here. I understand that one of your tweets years ago bothered U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. You cautioned the U.S. not to rush into a deal to curb Iran's nuclear program, not to make a bad deal. That deal has been the subject of much criticism on the Republican side of the aisle and by many of, if not all, of the Republican candidates for president. But you were involved in the negotiations between 2006 and 2009. So in your opinion, the final deal that was reached, good deal or bad deal?
No, it's a good deal. You can always say, oh, some details, you know, could have been different. But in such a, you know, it's 159 pages. There are a lot of technical elements. You have at the end of the negotiation, which is always difficult, to have a global view of the deal. It's a good deal. It's a good deal in itself, and it's also the good deal compared to the alternative. You know, what is the alternative?
Do you understand the American Republican response to that deal? They say it's the worst deal. Donald Trump says it's the worst deal ever made. So do you understand that point of view? Why would it be considered that by anybody?
No, I don't understand. Again, as I've said, you can say, oh, maybe there, you know, some detail could have been better. But globally, you have to look at it and say and ask the question, is it preventing Iran from getting the nuclear weapon? And the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. You know, really, if the Iranians abide by the agreement, and we have the means to control it, to monitor the implementation of the agreement, and so far they are implementing the agreement, I think it's a good deal.
I understand why we would not want Iran to have nuclear weapons. I understand why we certainly don't want North Korea to have nuclear weapons. Does France have nuclear weapons?
Yes, we are a nuclear state.
We have nuclear weapons.
Mm.
Does Germany have nuclear weapons?
No.
Who explain to me from a diplomatic point of view how you enter into discussions with a country like Iran when you have nuclear weapons and you're telling them that they cannot. What kind of a discussion?
Actually, there was a deal.
That?
There was a deal around the in the 60s. The international community as a whole decided that it was important to stop the proliferation of the nuclear weapons. And simply to say the countries which have the nuclear weapons keep the nuclear weapons and take a commitment to disarmament, while the other countries take a commitment not to get nuclear weapons. And in exchange, they get nuclear support and aid to get civilian nuclear energy. It was the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. And it was signed by Iran. Iran has taken the commitment not to get nuclear weapons, which means that if Iran is not abiding by its signature, it was the end of the treaty. It means also that if Iran gets nuclear weapons, all its neighbors are going to get the nuclear weapons, you know, really for their own security. Turkey, Saudi Arabia, you know, would feel obliged.
But Iran is very distrustful of the United States, and perhaps with some justification, given our relationship with the Shah of Iran. Why would they trust us? Why would they want to be in a weaker position, from their point of view, without nuclear weapons?
Because they don't have the choice. Actually, the sanctions that have been voted by the Security Council including Russia and China, which means that it was not the West against Iran. It was the world against Iran. Also, the sanctions voted by the U.S., voted by the European Union, were hurting the Iranian economy. So at some point, the Iranians had to make a choice, a military nuclear program or the collapse, and the collapse of their economy. Mm. So they have decided to give up a program which was very costly and for economic reasons, because they needed the lifting of the sanctions.
You've been sounding very diplomatic on this interview today, and I got to tell you that everything I've read about, much of what I've read about you, talks immensely about your free speech.
Oh, it's getting dangerous there.
You have a legendary outspokenness, which is out of character, I think, for many people in the diplomatic corps. And columnist Maureen Dowd wrote in the New York Times that she was worried about you because she felt that you were one glass of silky Beaujolais and one sweet tart away from blowing up your life. Because of your outspokenness.
Actually, I don't like Beaujolais, so I have to say it would be more a glass of Bordeaux. Let's say a glass of Bordeaux.
Well, if you're one silky glass away of Bordeaux away from blowing up, do you agree with that?
No, the question in 2016 is very simple. What is the use of an ambassador? Let's look at France and the U.S. You have thousands of corporations working in both countries, hundreds of thousands of visitors in both ways. My authorities, the National Security Advisor of the President Obama calling, her counterpart in Paris. They don't need the ambassador to do it right now in 2016. So what is the use of an ambassador? I try to redefine the job. I'm experimenting. I can do it also because, in a sense, it's my last posting. But I want to see what I can do in a modern country like the United States. And I think it's necessary for me to use the social media to try to get in touch with as many Americans as I can. But if you are on the social media and if you tweet, France is in favor of peace, I'm not sure that I will be retweeted a lot.
Yeah.
So, I have to be, in a sense, not to have the usual diplomatic platitude. It means that I have to tiptoe on the red lines. From time to time, I'm crossing the red lines, but I don't do it on purpose. Mm. So, I'm experimenting, which means that, frankly, I'm committing mistakes, I guess. But so far, I have the trust and the support of my own authorities.
Well, social media has democratized communication.
Exactly.
Because everybody's had a right to their opinion and for years, and we've always heard this this phrase, speaking truth to power. Mm. People have probably always been able to do that if they want to put their neck on the line, but now they can broadcast it. It's not just a matter of one person talking to another. It's talking to millions of people on social media. Has that made your job more difficult? Has it made world leaders' job more difficult? Because they now see what people are saying, and they know that everybody else in the world is seeing what people are saying.
Of course, it's more complicated. It's also, in a sense, also you are obliged to play by the rules of the game, which means you have to answer, to respond to the people. My instructions were never respond to people. Never engage into controversies. And actually, I do engage with people. I've discovered that even if I say to somebody, I don't share your point of view, I think you're wrong, actually the person, is happy with that. Really, it's a way for me to consider that his advice has some value. So it's a new way of influencing the people through networking and not from top down top down approach. But again, I am experimenting. I have been on Twitter only since April 2014.
Okay.
Tomorrow I will give up, or maybe I will be ordered to give up by my authorities.
How many followers do you have?
I think 26 or 27,000 only.
Only.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I'm jealous because, you know, my American counterpart at the UN had hundreds of thousands of followers, so I was really jealous.
How difficult was the translation? Because you were at the UN for quite a while, and at the UN, all of the representatives from the various different countries are equal.
Yeah.
But you're certainly more open and frank.
Yeah.
Because you're in a situation where you are there to represent your country man to man, essentially. Mm. You can be more frank than you can, I would think, as an ambassador living in Washington and surrounded by other ambassadors from other countries. How has the transition been from UN to the ambassador to the U.S. in Washington?
Actually, I thought it would be much more difficult than it was. It's right that I was tweeting at the UN, and when leaving, I gave a party to the journalist, and I said, now I'm going to tweet only on the Bordeaux wine and on the tourism in France. Mm-hmm. But the American society, and including, you know, the administration, is so open. You know, the debate is so free in this country. That actually it has been much easier than I thought. Mm. And I defend the French policy. I don't criticize directly the American policy. I have some red lines, you know, really. But again, this country is so open. And you have, you know, specialists, think tankers, journalists on a lot of different issues, which allow me to enter in discussion, conversation with them.
When you say this country is so open, we say that all the time.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that we appreciate it. So from a European point of view or from a French point of view, what is the distinguishing factor of the openness that you've discovered here that you wouldn't necessarily see in France or other parts of Europe?
Well, I think that, in a sense, criticism of the authorities is widespread, and I think the American authorities, the American administration, has a much thicker skin than the European ones. Mm. I think that the reaction of the European authorities will be stronger and more immediate at the slightest criticism. You know, really is. So it will, you know, if I was posted in another country, including a European country, I think I will be more careful in my expression.
Is that because people are more formal as well as being more or being less open? They're also more formal.
Yeah, I think that's the fact.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, I think the American way is the good way. Mm. And in any way, with the evolution of the society, which are moving, all of them are moving in the same direction because of the social media, I think the Europeans are going to follow the same way.
You have said that for the French, President Obama was a second messiah. After George W., it was easy. But you've also called the president a mystery. Why is he a mystery?
No, I think first, when I said that he was a second messiah, it's a way of speaking, of course. You know, really, the problem is that humor, French humor, is not always translated very easily in American humor and vice versa. So it was humor, I should say, to the listeners.
Okay, so true. What was funny about that?
Exactly. No, which means that in 2008, the after the difficult relationship that we had with, especially during the first mandate of George W. Bush, the first mandate, which is basically the invasion of Iraq, the relationship with George W. Bush and the administration improved during the second mandate. But it's true that the election of Barack Obama in 2008, an African-American president, was really considered all over Europe as really something extraordinary.
Yes, we've come a long way since the Freedom Fries period.
Exactly.
And you've pointed out that the G7, which is the group of the world's seven most successful economies, which include Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, that France, of those countries, France is the only one that has never been at war with the United States.
Yes, it's true.
I didn't know that. I was trying to think yesterday. Maybe I'm just missing it. When was Canada at war with us?
No, I think it's because, you know, Canada was part of, you
of,
know,
of,
part
of Great Britain.
Of Great Britain. No, because I say that because we have had the best family squabbles, the French and the Americans.
Right.
You know, the family squabbles are the worst squabbles, but I wanted to insist that's its family squabble. We are the oldest ally of the United States, 1778, the Treaty of Alliance between our two countries.
Not to mention the help in the Revolutionary War. Your folks, Lafayette and others, came over here. Now, but you're very critical of the city that Pierre L'Enfant built, Washington, D.C. You call it provincial, you say. I love this because I grew up there, and I think you're exactly right. But you say that the men dress in suits where their pants are much too large, the crotch is coming down, they have no imagination in colors, and out of the office they take their first jeans off the rack that they find. They don't care. You're sartorial.
Well, I think it's maybe that's after a glass of Bordeaux that I say that.
Look, don't apologize.
Yeah,
exactly right.
It's I'm not sure that I want that as the main memory of my mission in Washington D.C. Actually, I was posted in Washington in the 80s. It's the second time that I'm there, and the city has really dramatically improved since the 80s.
But you also say that the problem that Washington faces, and this is absolutely true, is that it's the political capital of the country. New York is the artistic capital. Paris is the capital of France. It is both the artistic and the political capital of your country. And we also have a problem in this country where people don't really care about politics. You get outside the Beltway, they don't really care about it. For them, politics is local. That makes it very difficult.
No, you're right, because, you know, not only Washington, D.C. is not the financial, not the economic, not the cultural capital of the country, but only the federal capital. So for me, I'm obliged to travel a lot in the country.
Which is why you're here, and we're thankful that you are. Thank you for spending the hour with us. I appreciate it very much. Gérard Arrault, the ambassador of France to the United States, here under the auspices of the World Affairs Council, Charlotte.